it won't be difficult to lunch.
Oh.
Okay, fortunately.
If I stand up, your pipe will be just.
Okay. Okay. So, yeah, we were just got stuck just before the lunch at well, sort of the last couple of slides about the UML phase part. And okay, so the yeah, I just talked about some examples about how you can include some aspects of statically critical systems in some sense in UML using stereotypes. And the last two slides about this are about again about the things that are happening under the surface of this approach on the level of the mathematical model underlying it. So firstly, I mentioned already there's this execution semantics for the simplified fragment of UML used in this context, and also some of the constraints I mentioned before actually refer to properties of the behavior of this execution semantics, and in particular also refer to possible influences of the environment of the software system. So for example, failures arising from the software from the hardware level to the to the software level. And so this needs to be somehow this behavior needs to somehow be included in the execution model of this UML fragment. And the way this works is sort of try to sketch this on this slide. So firstly, the situation is that we have our model of our given UML or the given system as modeled by our UML model consists of different components and links between the different components. So in the simple situation, we just have two nodes and a communication link between the nodes. There are certain failures which can arise, for example, with respect to the communication over this communication link. And I mentioned them earlier. So, just for presentation purposes, we here focus on firstly the loss, the delay, and the corruption of data. And this needs to somehow be the possibility of this needs to somehow be incorporated into the execution semantics of this UML model. So firstly, the semantics in itself will give us a state machine representing the component sitting on this node, and a state machine representing the component sitting on this node, and together with a part of the semantics which models the communication between the different components that are connected by communication links. So this is part of the semantics that we define for this fragment of UML. And I'm not actually going to go into that in too much detail because it's rather technical. But the point is, given that, so given in this simple example a state machine in this abstract state machine setting representing each of the two components and a mechanism modeling the communication, we now additionally get a kind of mechanism which includes this this possible failure behavior by the underlying hardware layer, with respect to the software, into the overall picture. And the way this works now is that, so without possible failure, what we have in our formal semantics is a sort of a link queue, if you like. So this is a buffer for the messages that are sent between the components. And at each iteration of this model, each component may send a message to one of these link queues in order to be delivered to the other component at the next iteration of the system. So that's the usual situation without the possibility to model this failure. And now in the setting of safety critical systems, this semantics is extended. Instead of just one buffer, there is for one buffer for each link between two components, there are there's a sequence of buffers for each time, each point in time n, that one buffer, and the meaning of that buffer is that it contains the number of messages, it contains the messages which will be delivered in n time units. So this is just a technical way of capturing the fact that we would like to model the delay in the communication or the delivery of the messages. So instead of one link queue, we have link queues for each natural number n, and the meaning is that the messages in that set will still have to wait n time units. And of course, after each iteration of this execution semantics, which is what I'm saying below here, the messages in the link queue get moved up one further step, if you like, namely from the queue n plus 1, representing the messages that still have to wait n plus 1 time steps, to the queue n, which have to wait only one less step. So this is sort of a technical way of modeling one of the aspects, namely the possible time delay. The next aspect is the possibility of loss of a certain value. The setting modeled by a sequence of probability values representing the possible failures which may arise. And so this may be going back to some of the earlier questions here. Each possible failure, such as a loss of a message, is assigned one probability value, so one number. And so this means that with each hardware component we associate one probability value, namely the fact that, or the probability that a value produced by the hardware gets the component gets lost. And of course this is also a simplification, because in general this is not so much of a simplification there, but the other aspect is that the delay, of course, similar to that, also would need in the most general sense, you would need to assign a probability distribution, a continuous distribution, which for each possible delay assigns a probability value to reflect the fact that the delay will happen with a certain probability. But that, while to handle continuous probability distributions in this context would probably be infeasible. So as a simplification there, we just consider the probability whether whether delay of the message is higher than what is stated in this as the argument of this delay action in the failure set. So instead of having a continuous distribution over the possible time delays, we just have one probability value, namely for the fact that a message gets delayed more than what would be allowed by the given time bound in the failure set. And then we get a sequence of probability values for a given history H, where history is a sequence of states of the specification under consideration. And each each UML model may have a set of histories in general, so there may be some non-deterministic behavior, and of course the environment may give different input to the system. So that's why you have a set of history sequences, and for each such history, we then have a sequence of probabilities where phn is the probability that at the end, a step in the history H, there will be a failure. So this is additional information we need to associate with the system history to incorporate the possible influence of the hardware level to the software level in terms of the failures, which I explained earlier. And if given such a sequence of possible failures, and suppose that that a given link is stereotyped with the stereotype S, which in its associated failure set actually has this loss failure included with the parameter P, then a possible continuation of this history is that the link Q at time zero associated with the link is set to the empty set. And in that case, the parameter, the probability that which was associated with the loss failure is appended to the sequence of probabilities considered so far. This way we get a new history together with a new sequence or an extended sequence of probabilities. And we get a second history which reflects the possibility that in fact the value is not lost, and this is captured by the probability 1 minus p, and this is again appended to the head of the sequence of probabilities, and this way we get a second possibility to continue this probabilistic history. So this is sort of one part of the definition to recursively define a sequence of states and associated probabilities, which not only reflects the internal state of the system, but also the failures that arise from the hardware level to the software level, and which includes this sequence of probabilities. But again, as a simplification, the probabilities are always discrete probability numbers as opposed to continuous distributions to keep the analysis feasible. And a similar thing we then do to the corruption failure. And there, instead of just deleting all the messages from the link queue, which is supposed to be delivered to the recipient at the next point in time. Instead of just deleting this head, the messages there are replaced by messages, well, each by a symbol which represents a corrupted message. So the message is not lost, but it's corrupted. This is modeled, and this is just here written just as this black square. And similar to the above, if this corruption happens in that situation, we have to append the probability Q to our sequence of probabilities associated with the given history, because this was the parameter of the corruption failure. And alternatively, we have another history, another possible world, if you like, and there the value is not corrupted, and therefore the link Q of the values that will be delivered at the next point in time is not changed, and we append 1 minus Q to this sequence of probabilities. And here, implicitly, as I said earlier, we make the assumption that the receiving component actually notices that the value here is corrupted. And as I said, this you can realize by making use of error detecting code. Otherwise, well, if you do not want to make this assumption, then instead of replacing it just by the special symbol, you would have to include a distribution or a probabilistic function which maps each possible value probabilistically just to a different value, where then the receiving component would not be able to notice in general that this is actually a corrupted value. But I just did it this way here to for simplification, to simplify the presentation. And lastly, to also take care of the delay failure. I already mentioned that. So firstly, we have different link queues, each representing the messages which still have to wait a certain number of time steps. And this is then, at each iteration, the messages are sort of moved forward one step towards being delivered to the intended recipient, which happens which happens with probability 1 over t, where t is the delay, the delay bound given in the failure set. So here we assume that within the time period consisting of these t time steps, we have a uniform distribution that each value is delivered at one of the time steps, which again is also a simplifying assumption. But in principle, you could replace all of these simplifying assumptions by the more general assumption, but then the analysis framework would be more heavyweight, so you would only have want to do that if you really think that it's necessary. So I don't know, this is probably technically a bit more involved, but I hope the idea is sort of roughly clear what's happening here. So the main point is, firstly, you have a history, which is a sequence of states of your model system. Secondly, you have sequences of probabilities, which while modeling the possible environment events, such as failures arising from the hardware, and thirdly, you have these sequences of link queues for each link L, reflecting the fact that a message may be delayed by n time steps until it's delivered. And then you have this this environment inference modeled that way. And then considering this in the context of the execution semantics of the considered fragment of UML. This is the semantics is defined based on the notion of UML subsystem. So for each UML subsystem, this is sort of viewed again as a the system part in its own interest. And this UML subsystem, firstly, is able to receive input messages at each point of the iteration. Then, okay, so in general, your subsystem may itself be divided into different components by including a deployment diagram. And this means that the execution semantics has to model the communication between the between the components in the subsystem. So firstly, the messages are input into the subsystem, and then the semantics models the fact that within the subsystems, the input messages have to be distributed to the intended component within the subsystem. So it's possible to send a message specifically to one component contained in the overall subsystem. And this has to be modeled by the formal semantics supporting this approach. And then thirdly, as part of the second step, each of the components does its proceeds with its execution as specified, maybe by state charts, and this is modeled in the semantics. And then, thirdly, each of the components may produce again a new output in itself. This output is then again distributed over the link queues between different components within the subsystem, or to the output queue of the overall subsystem. And lastly, the failure model, which I just explained on the previous slide, is then after each iteration of the semantics is applied to each of the link queues between the components. Yes. Okay. So this was the end of this part about UML safe. So are there any questions about this point? Yes. Because otherwise, I will now start with the security part. And in the end, I'll say something about tools and model-based testing. So yeah, because most people seem to be mostly interested in safety, I extended the safety part a bit in the morning. And now I will go through the security part a bit more quickly. So firstly, now some motivation for considering security. This is probably on most people's minds by now, even if one is not working on security oneself, that security in the last couple of years has received an increasing amount of attention, because we are increasingly relying on computer networks for all kinds of functions in the society and economies. The problem is that these networks are intrinsically vulnerable. For example, the internet was not originally built to be secure and not even to be used by large numbers of users who may not be to be trusted, but originally it was built for just for the use in, for example, between scientists and on a much smaller scale and not necessarily to be used for commercial purposes or for a critical infrastructure of whole nations. And so it's not designed to be as secure as it would really need to be used in the way it is today. And so you need to sort of install the security on top of the transportation layer using security protocols, which is of course what's being done. But this then raises problems of firstly how to design these protocols correctly, which is difficult enough, and then also how to use these protocols correctly within the system context. As I mentioned earlier, there are enough problems with computer security, and many of them relate to the internet, as we are probably aware, almost painfully, I would say. And even as a user oneself, one has to really fight with, you know, viruses and whatever vulnerabilities come up, and, you know, apply patches and so on and so on. This is the general motivation, of course. Then, just very quickly, what is security about anyway? So, much of it is about data security. For example, that information should not be leaked out to unauthorized parties. So, this is called confidentiality or secrecy. Then, information should not be able to modify it without authorization. This is called integrity, and the information or the services should be available to the required standard, and it should not be possible to disrupt the service more than it is required. And slightly less well-known security requirements may be that of authenticity, meaning that it should be possible to verify what the source of an information is. For example, to avoid that some fake information is produced and in the name of others without authorization to do so. And sort of conversely, it should be possible to make someone responsible for the information produced earlier. And there, the standard example is that if you sign a contract, then it should not be possible later to claim that you did not sign the contract. So, similar to secrecy and integrity, that are somehow in a way dual to each other, going in different directions. This is similar with authenticity and non-replicability, which also try to secure the link between information and human users in both ways, depending on what you actually need. I mean, as always, you don't always need all security requirements. And it's also the case that some of the requirements actually contradict each other. Another one, like anonymity, which I did not mention here, is can be in conflict, for example, with authenticity or non-reproducibility. But this just as a short introduction about what kind of requirements one is considering here, and in our security also specifically, there are many problems, and not only those related to viruses or hacked websites or even lost credit card numbers, but also more serious ones. And this is actually a bit older, but I used it anyway because it shows that security incidents may at least potentially have quite a serious impact. And this was demonstrated in 97 in a demonstration only, not in real life, but this NSA helper team actually would have been able to bring down the the electric power grid system and emergency systems. And of course, there are now some people speculating that maybe the problems in North and Western USA a couple of weeks ago might also have been related at least to viruses, but well, as far as I know, this is only speculation and depends on how much you like speculation. But you know, this shows that if these things go wrong just accidentally, then there may also be a scope for someone to do it on purpose. So it's an important problem. And you may wonder why this is still a problem, although of course security has been considered for decades now, even though the internet was not designed to be secure, or maybe even just because of that, people from early on started to think about how to provide security anyway in networked systems. And starting with the 70s, tried to design security protocols which deliver security requirements even over otherwise untrusted networks. But the problem is that this is very difficult to write these protocols, although they often only really consist of a couple of lines of code describing what messages should be exchanged between the communication partners, but the difficulty is that the correctness of this execution is always relative to a possible adversary interfering with the execution. I mean, that's the whole point. In the internet, it is relatively easy to insert packets on the communication layer, and thereby you may, of course, eavesdrop on internet communication even more easily. In that way, you may interfere with the actual execution of a given protocol. So this makes it so difficult to see whether a security protocol actually enforces the security requirements it's supposed to enforce. Because you not only have to look at the specified behavior of the system components that are involved, but also at the possible behavior of external adversaries or more or less internal adversaries. There it becomes very difficult to see this with the bare eye, to see whether a protocol is correct in a certain sense. And a famous example in that setting shows that even the experts in the field may miss some subtleties there. This is why there's also a lot of work in formal methods also been done in that direction of analyzing formal specifications for security requirements. For example, also Gavin Lowe, who found this second kind of attack on the protocol, is also working on these issues using, for example, the process algebra CST. So this is one problem, or one big problem, why things are difficult. Second problem as in the safety case, sometimes developers may not have so much background, and this security may be especially the case because it's only recently that security has become so important in a commercial setting, or let's say network security. Previously, in the commercial setting, security was considered to be something like, well, you have to lock your computer securely in a room which only authorized people have a key for, and so on. It's not so easy anymore. As I said earlier, in security it's also especially the case that people try to develop the product and ship it to the customer, and let it get ripe while it is there, you know, the banana approach, the way.
Okay, yeah, I think. No, not me anyway. No? Yes? Okay.
Okay, so. Yeah, so this is especially a problem with security, problem, I would say. More causes. Yeah, although there's a lot of work on specific security mechanisms, for example, security protocols, and well, also encryption, and these by now are probably can be considered to be actually secure. For example, the encryption operations, these would probably not so easily be broken by a usual adversary. But then the problem is how they are used correctly in the system context. And there, most attacks address the way that the security mechanisms are actually used in the context of the system. And also making use of properties of the physical environment. So it's not possible to make your system secure by, let's say, using SSL to encrypt the internet connection, which is, you know, what you can often see with e-commerce websites, where they say, well, you can trust your secure data to us because we use SSL, but that's, you know, that's not really the whole story. Of course, it's probably something which is a necessary requirement for the whole thing to be secure, but not necessarily a sufficient one, because of course someone might be able to somehow hack into the back office database and get out your data that way anyway. And then, other kinds of difficulties in the security setting, or specifically the internet, is that often, as opposed to let's say to safety, there, if you have a failure, then you would not suddenly assume that another system of the same make would now suddenly be more likely to suffer from the failure to occur. If you look at, for example, at random hardware failures, then and if you assume that they are probabilistically independent, then just because in the past there was one of the components failed, then this does not mean that another component will be more likely to fail in the future. Or at least it would not be so obvious to say that. But if you look at security, then it's often the case that security weaknesses are published somewhere on hacker websites, for example. And this then actually means that once a failure has been discovered, then the next moment you can assume that, or in a very short time, you can assume that many systems are now attacked from all over the world. And so this is, in that sense, the situation is a bit more chaotic than in safety, where you would not assume such a behavior. And another problem in security is that if something goes wrong, then the developers sometimes or often don't even hear from the customers about that, because they would rather keep the problems to themselves, for example, to consider banks, rather than having a bad publicity. So the developers also don't usually get the feedback on how well they did with their systems. This, again, part of that I said earlier, previous approaches were, again, also just construct the system and distribute it, and then if someone finds the flaw, release a patch. But this has probably rather obvious disadvantages. It's insecure and it's annoying. And again, in this field also, form methods have been used, and there's been quite a lot of successful research in that direction. But again, here it's also difficult to make this used in industry. Maybe even more so than in safety, because if if in safety human life is threatened, then people will more or less be forced to use whatever methods are available, even if they are expensive. Whereas in security, even if there's a lot of money, which may be at risk, people are more likely to take the risk rather than to pay the additional cost in upfront. Apart, of course, from the military sector, which is different. So this is really parallel to what I said in the safety case. So just the same ideas here. And again, as I said earlier, especially in security, you also have to look at the system as a whole, because as the saying goes, the chain is always as strong as its weakest link, and you can assume that if some part of the system is vulnerable, then a motivated adversary will find and concentrate on the vulnerable part of the system. And also, secondly, many attacks address the borders between different views on the system or different components of the system. And that's also what makes security difficult. So, after this short motivation for the security part, I will now say a bit about the security extension for UML. And firstly, the general idea, as I said earlier, is really very parallel to the safety case. The requirements we've just seen. And again, the more technical ideas are also just very parallel to the safety case. Only now, of course, we have different kinds of requirements, so secrecy and so on, instead of different safety requirements. If we look at more specifically what requirements one can have on a UML extension for security. So firstly, certain security requirements should be provided as primitives. Again, this is done using stereotypes. And secondly, we should be able to incorporate different threat scenarios, which here correspond to the failure scenarios, which we considered in the safety critical part, and be able to include important security concepts and security mechanisms. And this is what in the safety part corresponds to the redundancy mechanisms, which I talked about there. And also, one would like to be able to provide certain security primitives, such as cryptographic operations on the level of the model and on an abstract, with an abstract view on it. Of course, it would probably not be feasible to model this on the level of the actual manipulation of bit sequences that is happening when you apply an encryption, but instead to model it in an abstract way, which, well, I will explain in more detail how this works, but in principle, you consider encryption as an abstract operation with two inputs, namely the plain text and the encryption key, and one output, namely the cipher key. And then conversely, you need a decryption operation, which is also given as an abstract function. And you then just need an equation, which ensures that if you decrypt ciphertext, then you get with the correct key, then you get back what you started out with. And that's the level of abstraction that encryption is considered here. And this is in a way similar to our assumption about using error detecting code in the safety situation, where we also made this assumption that if a data value is corrupted, then the receiving component will notice the fact that it is corrupted. And you can also be able to use this approach to, again, to consider the side of the human user of the system. And it would be useful to also be able to include domain-specific features such as Java security and so on. So, but these different features are actually rather parallel to what we did in the safety situation. So this may indicate that safety and security can be seen as, at least at the technical level of analyzing models for failures or for possible attacks, could actually be seen in a rather parallel way. And hopefully this, there could be some more convergence between the two communities, which sort of in the past have been almost separate. And to formulate this as a slogan, the difference between the two extensions, or maybe the difference between safety and security in general, this is actually also probably also a bit controversial. The second kind of view on this would be, I think, safety, the distinction between whether a system should be secured from its environment, or whether the environment of the system should be safe from the system. And this is a sort of alternative view of distinguishing between safety and security, which focuses more on the outcome of possible incidents. But if you look at, again, at the technical level of what you have to analyze in order to establish the safety or security requirements, then the main difference is that in security you look at possible adversaries, and in safety you consider possible failures. And then you could say, well, a failure is something like a stupid adversary. It is also an influence on the system component under consideration, such as in this case, which I demonstrated, values getting lost or being corrupted. But you would generally assume that there is no will behind this and no strategy. And this, sometimes you can assume that this is happening, and even assume that it's happening randomly. Whereas in security, you cannot assume that, but you have to assume that the attacks at the present point in time, or the possible attacks by an adversary, depend on what happened in the past. For example, what kind of information the adversary has already received about the system, and what data values were already sent to the adversary. And also, while the use of probability is at least not so common in the security area, you could use it in the context of generating cryptographic keys, because that is actually done probabilistically usually, but you usually extract from probabilities there just to keep the reasoning feasible, because security and the interaction with adversaries is complicated enough not to have, again, also have probability included. So that's one view of, you could view the extension, the difference between threat and security. And conversely, well, you could say, even if you consider failures in safety, then for, well, in a very unlikely event, it could actually be the case that, you know, a failure occurs, which is so unlikely that it looks like almost there's a strategy behind it, that whatever fails, you know, there are, let's say, four different kinds of things that have to fail consequently for a hazard to take place, and this is of course very unlikely, but it's not completely impossible. So if you really want to be very safe, then you again sort of almost get close to what you would have to consider in security in terms of verification. So in that sense, there are differences in taste or in spirit, but it's sort of two ends, the two opposite ends on one, on the same scale, you could say, in some sense. And that's also why one can use in principle the same kind of approach, both safety and security, on and in the context of model-based development with an extension of UML. But yeah, I mean, this is probably also something which one could discuss, this view of the relationship between safety and security. And I said this is probably something from the specific point of view of analyzing a system for weaknesses. Yes, and then considering the different kinds of diagrams, this really corresponds to what the diagrams are really supposed to express. So, for example, activity diagram is supposed to model the control flow of a system. So here you can then make use of or make sure that the control flow is taking place securely. And here, similarly to what we saw on the preservation of safety levels, this you can also do with the security levels, and so on, with different kinds of diagrams. And similar to what we've seen in the safety setting, we have a profile consisting of different kinds of stereotypes, applying to different kinds of model elements, and some of them have tags and or constraints associated with them. This is just sort of an overview, and I will now also explain some of the stereotypes. So firstly, as in the safety setting, you can associate information about the physical layer of the system using stereotypes. So stereotypes, previously there was this stereotypes which allowed you to associate a certain failure semantics with physical links or components, and now you have these stereotypes which allow you to associate security relevant information. For example, now instead of having failure sets, we have threat sets, and they are similarly to what we've seen before, certain things can happen. For example, on a internet link, as I said, it's rather easy, so it's possible for a default adversary with no specific knowledge or too specific knowledge or no too strong probabilities to delete messages that are exchanged over the internet link, or to read the messages, or to insert messages into the link. Whereas if you have an encrypted internet connection, it would usually not be possible for a usual adversary to read or insert messages, but maybe still be possible to delete messages, for example, just by bringing down a network server. And yeah, in the end, we have this similar to before. We have now a threat set, and additionally, we have this access threat, which means that which can be associated with a component in the system rather than a link, and which means that this component can somehow be accessed by an adversary. And this is useful if you consider internal adversaries rather than external adversaries. For example, an internal adversary would have direct access to a local area network, whereas an external adversary would probably not have that access.
About security levels in the same sense, I think, of the same safety levels. In safety levels, you have tried to define catastrophic, frequent, whatever. And here, for security level, what do you mean, correspondent?
You can also consider security levels in this setting, and one of the later stereotypes in introduces security levels. Only I did now in the introduction, I did not mention that. So in the, at least in the formal methods for security community, you often you are not very specific about that. You just say, I take a security lattice as given, where lattice, well, refers to the mathematical lattice, but what's important is just that, it doesn't actually have to be a lattice in the mathematical sense, but just that sometimes, let's say, in the military setting, you would have something like, as we know from the usual movies, you know, you have top secret, and top secret, and then below that, whatever, I don't know, it depends on where you are exactly, so secret, then there are different levels still, and then maybe public, at some point, but you may have different levels in between, and it may be more complicated. It's also about who is able to delegate what to whom. So if you look at the military setting, you may have different combinations of security levels, and because they can be combinated, you get a lot of high number of different kinds of levels. But the point is that what you really just need is some kind of order. Or more precisely, a lattice, as I said, meaning that if you have two levels, let's say public and whatever, delegate something, then, of course, you also have a combination, and that would be in the lattice, the level, whatever it's called, that is includes both of the lower safety levels. And that's why you usually refer to a security lattice, a lattice of security levels.
But for certainly the meaning is the damage, the consequences, and the probability of occurrence. But there, you cannot, how you class, because this is in terms of confidentiality, but you have also other attributes for defining security. So the classification is not so immediate.
So here I'm using different safety levels which correspond to the different
data security requirements, such as secret. Here I'm just using secret rather than top secret and so on, just for simplification, but you could also do that. And levels such as integrity and so on. So we see that on the next slides. But in general, it's different from the safety case. That's true. I mean, yes. So there's probably a difference in the approach. So here it's really more focused on the requirements on specific data, and that you can sort of see as security levels. Otherwise it's rather parallel. And yeah, to explain the different kinds of stereotypes. So here we're actually using another kind of diagrams, which I didn't mention before, because it doesn't play such a prominent role in this approach, but this is just to demonstrate that you can also use it here. It's the use case diagrams, and that use case diagrams you usually use in early phases of the system development, often to discuss requirements with customers. These you can then also use to include security requirements early on in the design process, using stereotypes. So in this example, we have this very basic and very initial specification of a sales application, where we just say that a customer wants to buy some goods, and the business wants to sell the goods, and we have this high level or this abstract requirement of the exchange, meaning that the transaction should be fair to both parties, in the sense that, what this means more technically, we see in the next slide, actually. And, here at this point, you just put in this label, fair exchange, whatever this means in detail, we don't know yet, but just to be able to express it already on this level. And the constraint in a way is then that when you give more detail, for example in an activity diagram as on this slide, this should also be and this requirement should also be included on that level, and there it actually does have a technical meaning, and this is explained here. Namely, we have associated with the stereotype, we have again two tags, namely the buy tag and the sale tag, which allow you to specify states in the activity diagram. In this case, it's a very standard situation where you say that firstly the customer is supposed to pay, and then later the customer is supposed to be delivered the good or be able to reclaim the money. And so this is sort of the start and the stop of the transaction. And the requirement is now that whenever you start with the buy state, where the customer, for example, pays for the good upfront, you should eventually reach a sell state in order to make sure that the transaction is fair also for the customer. And this is actually what is fulfilled in this specification. Then you have this stereotype secure links, which is now parallel to what we've seen in the safety case, except of course now we consider the influence of the threats, so the attack from possible adversaries, rather than the failures, and we have different requirements namely now secrecy and integrity, for example, and the different threats correspond to the requirements in the way that if, in the example, again, in this situation, you have different components sitting on different nodes connected by links with stereotypes which include threat scenarios and connected by dependencies which may carry security requirements. And then in the case of security of the secrecy stereotype, it should be the case that there is no read threat in the threat set associated with the link over which the dependency goes in a way. And in integrity, should not be the case that there is an insert thread at the link over which the dependency is situated. And of course, now there's a question here, and I just realized that probably in the printout, you now have to try not to look at the next slide, which I probably should not have said, because now you're too tempted to do it. So the intention was to ask you whether the constraint is violated here in this example. So if you try to do as if you had not seen the next slide, then any opinion on that? So again, as I said, we consider the stereotypes connected with the communication links, and with each stereotype, like with internet a couple of slides ago, I defined that given a default adversary, and we have certain threats, I mean, including all of delete, read, and insert, given the default adversary. And so, secondly, we have the secrecy dependency, and now thirdly, we have the secure links requirement on the overall subsystem. So, if we check the constraint associated with the secure links stereotype, then since we have a secrecy dependency which goes over a communication link L, we have to consider the link L carries the stereotype internet. We have to check whether the read thread is contained in the thread set of the adversary, the default adversary and the internet stereotype. And again, a couple of slides ago, we said that in fact read is included in this thread set. So unfortunately, this part of the constraint is then violated. And this is what is pointed out here. So, in principle, in this very simple example, you could still say, it's obvious that you don't have secrecy if you just communicate data without encryption over an internet link. The data is not secret against a standard adversary. But the point is that in a larger system, it would be a bit tedious to check that by hand. And there may be situations where it's not so obvious. For example, if you have if you encrypt your data and at certain points during the transport of the data, you have to decrypt and re-encrypt the data because for legacy reasons, your system uses maybe different encryption mechanisms in different parts, then at that point you would actually have a break
and you could detect that using this this approach. And although this would not be so obvious without, but yeah. Anyway, this is a check more on the static level of the system, which is also again more of a consistency check, similar to the earlier checks in the safety part, and again similar to the earlier safety stereotype. Now we have a secure dependency, and this also now makes sure that the different security levels between different components of the system are preserved by the communication dependencies. And so this is really, again, rather parallel to what we've seen before in the example in the safety case. So again, one could wonder whether here now the secure dependency requirement is fulfilled, meaning that whenever we have a call dependency between two objects, then whenever the security requirements on the data that is exchanged over the dependency is actually preserved. And yeah, in this case, again, questions? Someone?
Could you just go back to number 67? So from this you discovered that the constraint isn't upheld.
Mm-hmm.
But if you wanted to change the diagram and put a block in the middle here, which mm-hmm. was on both sides, an encryption, decryption mm-hmm. module mm-hmm. on each side,
mm-hmm.
but then an open internet between those two modules.
Mm-hmm.
Just graphically on the diagram, how would you express that you wanted the whole link from the left to the right to have secrecy, even though the one in the middle doesn't have secrecy? How would you express that with these stereotypes? Because if your method here is straight, okay, this doesn't work, so we have to redesign.
This is actually an example later in the. Since you asked, you can totally have a look at it. Just have to find it. Let's see. This is the secure channel pattern. Yes, and this is on slide 104. So there, I can just jump to that because it's related to this slide. I think it's 104. Let's see. No.